So this is the second day of our seven-day retreat here at Southern Dharma. And the text that we used to call Verses on the Faith Mind, but we, after the Dharma talk yesterday, we realized that may not be the most accurate translation, so we'll see what happens in the future. But for now, we'll call it, as it's called, Trust in Mind, the mind that can be trusted. But before we resume, there was a question about somebody wanting to, whether during the solitary practice they could kind of just do something on their own, like play their music quietly in a secluded place. And my suggestion is not to. The same way we don't read or we don't write, it's good to stay within the container of the retreat. Not to say that one cannot make music mindfully. You know, there are many things one can do in that practice. But I think for this retreat, it's not good for us to kind of go off and do our solitary activities other than just the meditation that we have with us. And preferences. It's good to, you know, I think renunciation has a bad rap. Especially in our culture, I mean, sort of the opposite. In our culture, it's like, you know, the object is to, you know, accumulate as much as we can. The idea of renunciation does not make us happy. and actually, traditionally, renunciation is not the path of the layperson. Renunciation is the path of the monastic. As you can see, if you live in a monastic situation, the realm of picking and choosing and personal preferences is severely limited, right? I mean, you don't have to worry about your hairstyle because you have no hair. You know, you don't have to worry about the clothes you wear because you can only wear your robe. You can't worry about food you like or dislike because you have to eat what's ever put in front of you. So in that case, and again, that is, you know, why is that? It's just for this reason. So you really very clearly, you know, you renounce preferences. You know, the downside of that is you may not really renounce preferences. You may just have to. So there is a danger in the path of renunciation that it's a more mechanistic type of doing without preferences. And, you know, when the monastic gets out in the world, and all of a sudden the constraints of their environment are taken off them, all these, if the seeds of desire and longing and grasping and attachment have not been uprooted, then they can all flower again. But having said that, and especially in terms of our talk yesterday about the world of preferences, I think it's good to play with it. There probably are many things in all our lives that we prefer, big things and little things. And just to say no to the things that we habitually prefer and to say yes to the things that we habitually don't prefer can be very helpful in terms of practice, in terms of training. Traditionally, until we become fully enlightened Buddhas, we are in the process of what's called training. We are training in mindfulness. We are training in concentration. We are training in insight. We are training in the six paramitas. We are training in the Eightfold Path. And this training doesn't go on only in a training facility like this, but really goes on every day throughout our life and all our experiences. So as lay people, since we do not live in an environment where restraint on our personal preferences is being force from the outside, we need to do it ourselves. And so it's good to say no to him or her and to watch how he and she deals with it. Now I'm talking about yourself. Right? It's good to say no and watch how he or she deals with it. And it's good to say yes to things that you prefer to say no to. Because as was presented yesterday, in picking and choosing, in liking and disliking, the world of liking and disliking, the world of preferences, the world of picking and choosing, is the world of of self, which means it is the world of conditioning. I think as Sam pointed out yesterday, he realized that many of the things that he likes or dislikes in terms of food or taste, he's just been conditioned to. Why do you prefer this or that? Right? I mean, as a child, as an infant, the only thing you preferred was your mother's milk. Right? One thing. Right? And how did you get from one thing to 10,000 things? Right? Do you remember that infant? Have you seen one? They only prefer one thing, and they are satisfied with one thing. And when they are finished with their one thing, they are happy, content. Right? And us, we need so many things, right? I mean, if we went down to the dining hall and they gave us the same thing every day, we would be what? Dissatisfied. And we would be writing on the evaluation forms at the end, Carol be hearing clearly, you know, because why? Because we prefer what? Variety. We always want things to be different. But why is that? Because of our conditioning. There's nothing intrinsic in variety. I mean, there may be health concerns, nutritious concerns, but one could find a nutritious 3 meals a day and have that for the rest of one's life, right? And be perfectly healthy. What is it that demands variety? It's our personal preferences. And what is the source of our personal preferences? Please look deeply into that. So you can be free. Free of what? Free that you can go down there and have different meals all the time, and you can go down there and have the same meal all the time, and you will not be disturbed. Right? Remember, you came into life only knowing your trusting mind, your Buddha mind. You were just pristine awareness. In a little body. And over time, things just became more complex and complicated. And the self and the conditioning merged, and things became quite complex. And as our minds became more complex, unfortunately, we demanded more complexity in life until we are at a point where if we're not, you know, constantly having new foods and new music and new experiences and new books and new plays and new, you know what I'm saying? And new information and new news every hour, we are what? That for yourself. Trust in mind. Please, this is a fundamental point. Most of us, again, know our thinking mind, our mind of liking and disliking, the mind of I and me and self, the mind that picks and chooses, right, that pursues and avoids, and is endlessly, endlessly involving us in an internal dialogue about all this stuff. Right? But there is it's not really another mind, but there is another aspect of this mind, which, as we said yesterday, is pristine, is original, is uncontaminated by preferences. It is like pure water. It is like pure air. Right? Air is just here, isn't it? It is available. Right? Good people breathe air. Bad people breathe air. Young people breathe air. Old people breathe air. Right? Animals breathe air. Reptiles breathe air. Plants take in air and do what they do with it. And yet air itself does not judge, does not prefer, right? I mean, the air, the space in here is not going, I hope she breathes me in, and I don't like the way that one breathes me, right? Oof. Getting inside those lungs is a drag, right? We laugh because it's so stupid to think that pure space would care about that, because it's pure space. So this mind that the third patriarch is asked and he asks to believe in, so we can realize it and live from it and eventually totally trust it because it's our experience, is different. It's a different mind, right? And so each of us has a personal decision, because that other mind, the mind that's always talking to us, right, has our attention. And we pick and we choose and we get happy and we get sad and we get resentful and we get angry and we get scared and we think this about ourselves and that about ourselves, and you know, we think we're great, we think we're terrible, we think we're wonderful, we think we're horrible, right? And we think that same about everybody else. Is just this little mind that picks and chooses and judges and evaluates and makes something out of nothing. So even prior to full Buddhahood, prior to full Bodhisattvahood, prior to full Arhatship, prior to all the various stages of enlightened beings, one, if one pays attention and really listens to this text, one already can begin to move toward the mind of the Buddha, which is your own intrinsic mind. It is always here. And as the third patriarch said yesterday, what? It's a piece of cake. You know, just give up all your picking and choosing and all your preferences and how you think things have to be, and life has to be, and people have to be, and the world has to be. All of that is nothing but your own projections onto the world, fueled by a self that thinks it's right. The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. When love and hate, like and dislike, are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Make the smallest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. If you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinions for or against anything. So, heaven and earth are usually touching. Right? Heaven and earth exist in a larger harmony of heaven and earth. We could say the material and the absolute, or I mean, there are lots of ways of looking at heaven and earth, or we could say earth and sky, but we can see there is a harmony between them, even though we could say in one way they are different, yet they are part of a greater harmony. And if we look out the door or the window, we can see that earth and sky, or we can look in here and we can see a space and form, are coexisting as one thing. Right? When we look around this room, we see forms and we see space. Right? And they are one thing. But as soon as we go, this is space and this is form, that essential oneness is now separated. Can you see that? And that separation is not in form and space, it is in our minds. It is our mind that is making that distinguishment. I mean, if you look out the window, trees and rocks and bushes and earth and ground and space and sky, I mean, even to say that is to break it up. It all exists as it is. But we go, look at that tree, look at that rock, look at that, look at, you see what I'm saying? As soon as we label and name, we're just dividing up something that is already one with everything else. That tree has no separate existence from the earth that supports it. That rock has no separate existence from the earth that supported and created it. And when we just are willing to see things just as they are, without any labeling, without any distinguishment, the wonder and the indivisibility of things is right before our eyes. It's very clear. But when we start making the smallest distinction, we set this harmony apart. Then he says, if you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinions for or against anything. So, you know, it's sort of like, remember in the first verse, you know, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. And we said yesterday, that's a choice that each of us has to make. Am I somebody who wants to walk the great way? Because only if I want to walk the great way and experience the great way would I then consider giving up my preferences. And here he goes, if you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinions for or against anything. Again, because he's one of those challenging questions. You know, do you want to see the truth? Do you really want to see things as they are? Then this is what you need to do. But if you're not one of those who want to see the truth, and most people don't want to see the truth, very few people want to see the truth. Right? People say, I don't want to hear it. Right? I don't want to hear the truth. I don't want to change. Don't tell me the truth. Right? People don't want, you know, people can be living all kinds of lives and be living with dissatisfaction, be living with unhappiness, be living with addictions, be living with depression, be living with anxiety, you know, be living with all kinds of things, be living with all kinds of self-created physical illnesses because of their weight, because of the way they eat or don't exercise, you know. Hey, do you want to hear the truth? Right? That all those things that you suffer from, you don't have to? What are people going to say to you? Darlene's shaking her head. What are people going to say to you? What? Yes. Really? Who do you hang out with?
Well, they say it, but then they don't.
Right, but, right, that's what I mean. Right, they don't. And many people don't want to hear it, right? I mean, if I'm, you know, indulging in all kinds of activities that are basically producing ill health for my body, ill health for my mind, I don't want to be around Charlie telling me, Fred, you know, it doesn't have to be that way. You want to hear the truth? I'm going to start avoiding Charlie, right? Or I'm going to think he's a what?
Crazy.
You're a nag. Gee, what a nag he is, right? I don't want to hear the truth. Leave me alone, Charlie. Let me indulge myself. I'm happy. Right? That's the way people are. True or not true? Yeah. And even though we look and we see in their bodies and in their faces and their lives that their unhappiness, they don't want to hear the truth. Right? Go down to your local bar around 12:30 and talk about alcoholism. You know, right, Martina? We'll send you down to the pub and right. I mean, they'd throw you out, wouldn't they? What a downer you would be. Right? So again, you know, this is serious. Are we someone who wants to see the truth? Because the truth is, you know, there are many people even coming to retreat. It's very difficult for many people, right? Because when you come to retreat like this, especially a long retreat like this, you're kind of stuck, aren't you? And who are you stuck with? Yourself, the person you've been running from for years, right? You know, because we don't want to even see the truth about ourselves, do we? And many people don't like to even meditate, because what do they see when you meditate? You see the condition of your mind, and you go, oh my God. Right? Get me out of here. I'm going to go back on the computer with things here. You know, I can just cruise. And I'm the master of my fate. But I don't want to have to sit with my own mind. We don't want to see the truth. It takes courage to see the truth. Courage, it takes bravery. Because often what we see could be painful. Many of us, when we begin our practice, when we stop and we cultivate some mindfulness, we see there's a lot of suffering right inside us. some of it recent and some of it long term. We see, again, a mind that is out of control. We see all kinds of habit energies, things we do that when we look deeply are so self-serving that people like us who have pretensions of altruism and selflessness are often disgusted when we see how self-serving and manipulative even so many of our good acts are. So it takes a courage to take an unvarnished look at ourselves, for starters, right? To see the truth. But that's when things get real, right? That's when Dharma becomes meaningful. Because Dharma is the remedy for that. So when we see the truth, we're just like, somebody in the ER, right? They bring in somebody's all, messed up. And the response of the ER team is what? Let's get to work. Right, that's all. Let's just get to work. Right? Because we have the tools. Right? We have the competencies to heal those wounds, to fix what is broken. Right? And that's what Dharma is about. If you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinions for or against anything. We would have hoped he would have just said, then hold no opinions for or against. There's a little wiggle room in that. But he said, anything. Again, now what is this truth that he's really referring to here? It's a truth that things are just what they are. And to say this is good, this is bad, this is right, this is wrong, is just the self projecting onto reality its own conditioned perceptions of what is essentially free of all that. Again, pretty, ugly, flower, tree, pink, white, these are just things we make up. We can see that just as it is, without having to distinguish anything about it, don't we? Because when we distinguish anything about it, we are entering what? The world of words, the world of concepts. And we think that's what's real. Right? I think this is beautiful. Andrew over here thinks this is ugly. Right? I think whoever put this together did a good job. He's over there thinking, God, if Nancy was here, she could make a much better arrangement than this garbage. I mean, that's what Andrew's thinking, right? And I think it's the most beautiful thing in the world, and whoever did this should be nominated for the Queen of Ikebana. And that whole distinction is only going on where? In the realm of words, in the realm of thoughts, in the realm, it's not happening in this. This is just this. Right? And when we see that, again, it doesn't mean, that if Andrew was in charge of the meditation room, and if he really thought that it could be done differently, that he might not say it. Remember we said yesterday, it's about attachment. It's about, that clinging, that thinking you're right. So somebody may make a suggestion, oh, maybe you could do it differently, right? That's all. And somebody could say, yeah, all right, that's good. Why not? Things become easy when you don't hold strong opinions. Right? We say, it's got to be done this way. Right? And then, Andrew's over there saying, it's got to be done this way. And now we have what? Division. But if I'm willing to say, I think it should be done this way, Andrew's willing to say, I think it should be done this way, Andrew's willing to say, well, that's interesting, Fred, I never thought of doing it that way. I say, Andrew, that's interesting, I never thought of doing it that way. Now we have what? Communication. Joint problem solving, you know what I mean? Everything is open now. Everything is doable. We can work together. But if we begin with what? I'm right. Strong opinions come from attachment and come from a self that identifies with its own projections as if they're real and true and solid. It's not that way at all. Make the starless distinction in heaven and earth. If you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinions for or against anything. What do you think your mind would be like without all its opinions? If you just spent today listening to your internal conversation that you have with yourself, that we find so illuminating, so persuasive, right? I mean, this high-order internal dialogue that we think we're having. But just log opinions. Right? How many opinions? Can you go through an hour not having an opinion about something? A day. Endlessly spewing forth opinions about this and that. And then believing they're right. And again, these could be little opinions about the flowers. I mean, we sit down to meditate, right? And 5 minutes into it, we've already generated an opinion about how we're doing, right? Based on what? On our opinion. Right? As if our opinion has anything to do with reality. Because our opinion goes what? Good or bad? Like, dislike? I like what's happening. I'm having a good meditation. I don't like what's happening. I'm having a bad meditation. I should be this. I should be that. And yet the truth is, things are just what they are. And our job is simply to work with what is and not generate endless opinions about everything. Because from opinions come feeling states, mind states, right? If we think we're having I'm really getting this. I'm having a good meditation. We feel what? Happy. Charlie goes, hey, I'm happy. He gets a little proud and cocky. Posts a little sign in front of his meditation cushion. Good meditator, Charlie, wants to tell everybody about it, right? Then what happens? One round later, terrible meditation. Right? Now we're disgusted with ourselves, frustrated. Forced to remove the sign. But can you see, it just goes on and on, right? Hour after hour, day after day, week after week, endlessly spewing forth these opinions, which again create all these types of emotionality and moods, right? And that just within ourself, right? But we also have opinions about everybody else and everything else, right? No wonder we're exhausted, right? So, I mean, we just get it in all directions. Liking, disliking, happy, unhappy, satisfied, dissatisfied. Relaxed, frustrated. Right? That's called the world of delusion. The world of conditioned existence based on I, self. So please, again, we're in retreat. We're not reading newspapers. We're not, right? Things are very simple. Do your best to let go of your opinions. You can't help but have opinions because that's your conditioning, right? But you can, when they arise, you can see them from what they are and just let them go. Again, whether these are opinions about your meditation, your practice, yourself, food, right, whatever it is, let go of your opinions. Which again, you know, do not consciously generate them, and if they arise spontaneously, just see them for what they are and let them go. And you can laugh. It doesn't have to be heavy. Laugh. It is so silly, this mind of ours, like a child. Sometimes a child, sometimes a complete grandiose egomaniac. Either way, it's stupid. It's ignorant. Right? So we can just laugh and let it go. How silly. How silly this immature mind of mine is. Doesn't have to be heavy. Now, verse 3, we're making progress. Yesterday, I only go through one verse. So today we've already done one verse, and now we're on to verse. And again, as you can realize, there's so much can be said about each of these things, but I know that you prefer me to keep moving along. So. Well, let me just quick take a look. Let me see if anybody says it any differently. I mean, some of these people are pretty... most of them pretty much say the thing. Oh, those ones who do take very, but really look at it more from practice. They're the ones who said the great way is effortless for those who live in choiceless awareness. To choose without preference is to be clear. Their translation of verse 2 is, even the slightest personal preference and your whole world becomes diluted. To perceive reality as it is to live with an open mind. Nice, right? So that again talks, and again, it was nice the way they put in choiceless awareness and clarity in the first verse. So another way to say, well, how do I perceive things just as they are? Have a totally open mind, right? An open mind is not a closed mind. An open mind is not a biased mind. An open mind is what? The door is open. When the door is open, it means what? Anybody can come in. It's like that. When the door is open, I can see everything. I don't just open it when I want. Close it when I want. Open door. When you have an open mind, it is a mind that holds everything in simple mindful awareness and does not pick or choose, does not accept or reject, and is present to whatever is. That's an open mind. It's response when, you know, when I've just gone on and said this is a beautiful flower arrangement, and Andrew says this is the worst arrangement I ever say, an open mind goes what? Oh, well, that's interesting how you see it. I never saw it that way. Tell me why you see it that way, right? The closed mind goes what? Doesn't even listen, or goes, what an idiot. I mean, what the hell does he know about flowers? See, can you see how we do that all the time? That's the closed mind. But the open mind is open. And again, don't see it as some kind of metaphysical reality. The open mind is in all our life, is in our relationships. You know, is with ourself. Are you open to yourself? Right? Open means what? Whatever comes up from within my mind, I'm open to. Whatever I've done in my life, I'm open to. It is what it is. I don't pick and choose. A lot of people, when they tell the story of their life, they like to pick and choose, kind of sanitize it. Trying to manipulate the one we're telling it to either get them to like us or respect us or think this about us or not think that about us, right? It's always, that manipulation is always in the service of self. It was trying to protect. It knows it doesn't really exist, so it has to keep the image going. Give it up. So they say even the slightest personal preference in your whole world becomes diluted to perceive reality as it is to live with an open mind. So please, sort of the other side of when we talked about really practice today, not having opinions, is have an open mind to everything. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, be totally open to it. Don't judge, don't assess. Are there any questions about this? Before we move on to the next verse, this is radical stuff. Actually, it's interesting. Well, he called this book "The Rebellion of Chinese." Well, it's more scholarly, but I would say this is radical stuff. I grew up and went to elementary school and junior high school and college and university. I never heard this. I never heard this from my parents. I don't know. So this is radical stuff, right? Yes.
So in that last part you just read, they translated it as, if you have an opinion, then your whole world is deleted, which is kind of interesting. It's like it's sort of a poison that spreads out to everything. It's not just like, well, okay, here I have this opinion, but all the whole rest of my existence is just wonderful. I thought it was kind of provocative to translate.
Yeah, I mean, obviously these people are provocative and they're taking a lot of license, but they are saying that, right, what is, you know, where does it begin? And it begins at that very minute process of making distinctions, holding an opinion for and against. And that just elaborates, right? That elaborates the delusion. The delusion of what? That we do not perceive things as they are. We perceive them as we think they are. What's that?
I was just thinking about life and death, and about people who, if one is about to witness somebody being murdered, what is the preference? Maybe the preference is to run. I don't know, but is what he's
saying
in there that you know, it just is what it is.
No. And yes. So it is important, and I'm glad you brought this up, that we not hear this as some kind of nihilistic, nothing matters, right? He's talking from the point of view of practice and of self, right? And what causes suffering and delusion in an individual human being. Okay. So when he talks about, you know, let go of your rigid opinions. And again, he said yesterday, as we said yesterday, to say that we don't have preferences is to miss the point, because of course we have preferences. You know, I prefer to take this, you know, when we drove up from St. Petersburg to Athens, Georgia, we prefer to take this route than that route. Right? I mean, we were always making, do I stop now? Do I stop at this rest stop or stop at the next one? So, you know, again, it's about attachment and grasping and all that. But again, this is all about from the point of view of self. Okay. Now, we know at the same time that within Buddhism, there's great emphasis on compassion, and there's great emphasis on, we could call it moral conduct, sila. It's the basis of it, the five mindfulness trainings. But those are kind of social, right? Those are social. And social has to do with what? In social responses or social ethics, at this point now we're talking about the greater good. We're no longer talking about the self. So it's sort of coming at it from it. So please understand, right, that when we say there's no right or wrong, you know, don't hold opinions for and against, you know, you want to kill them, you don't want to kill them, that's fine with me, right? you see what I'm saying? That is not what, that, you know, you know, that is a kind of extreme nihilism or whatever that, you know, that does not see the temporary reality of the world, and that just, you know, choices are made. Right, so you're absolutely right. But again, even when you make social ethical choices about acting in the world, again, how do we act in the world? To alleviate suffering. Again, it's done from understanding. It's not done from a strong opinion. See, some people act from strong opinions. You know, I'm a this, so therefore I do that. Right? They're coming from their head. And they think they're right. But we don't know if we're right. Right? I mean, I read something before I came up that, what was it? Libya. Libya, 6 months ago, I don't want to get into the politics of it, but, you know, there was this rebellion against Gaddafi, and all of a sudden, the people who were rebelling, were the victims of Gaddafi, so we what? So we said they were right, and we went in to support them, and we killed the Gaddafi people. So now there's reports that the people, these groups that we supported, are now killing people that they don't like and oppressing people. So that is why, there has to be an understanding. Right? A deeper understanding about this. But anyway. Yes?
I was just
going to
follow up on the ask you to say something about the idea of blind spots, which is like what you're saying.
Blind spots meaning, what about?
Well, if our opinions are kind of like a way of being closed-minded and mm-hmm. sort of like cataracts on our vision.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Mm-hmm. That blind spots. We don't see that we're doing that.
Yeah. So the question is, yeah, I'm sorry.
So I guess, yeah.
Again, you know, that's what practice is about, Beth. But Beth is saying, you know, I mean, a lot of this stuff, these opinions and these views and all these things we have, that we're blind to them, right? Why are we blind to them? Because they're ours, right? And they seem so natural and normal and right and true, and because they're the very stuff of how we've created this world of self. Right? There's no self as a thing, as an entity. But there is this endless, large, a morass of thoughts and feelings and perceptions and opinions, right, that we all believe is the manifestation of who and what we are, right? People would say, what? You know, some people might say, have no opinions? Right? There are a lot of people who go, have no opinions. They go, then what's life about? Right? I mean, go to your next Republican and Democratic committee meeting. What? Have no opinions? Isn't life all about having strong opinions, right? And rallying behind your opinions, right? Both socially and individually. So, people are blind. People don't see it this way. The Dharma teaches something different. So, how do we see? I like your analogy, right? We are blind. We are blind to the reality of the way things are. So how do we begin to get, how do we get the cataracts off? We meditate. We practice mindfulness. We practice concentration. Yes?
We experience that there's no end to blind spots. I think as long as we're human, there will be blind spots.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that?
And that's as long as we practice. Would you say, yeah. I would hope that over time our vision gets better. Okay. I would hope over time that we would see the big ones. Because delusion leaves a trail, Beth. And that trail is what? Suffering. Suffering meaning dissatisfaction, unsatisfactoriness, anguish, depression, anxiety. You know what I mean? Okay, that's the trail. Right? And you may not see what's causing it, but if you get better at seeing the trail, seeing the footprints, and are willing to follow them, you will see what's causing them. And you will become less blind. And if you're willing, again, to see the truth, which many of us aren't, but if you're willing to see the truth and act upon the truth of what your own investigation, you will become less and less blind. And that's why, again, it's good to in the interaction of relationships of all types, our blind spots are also uncovered. It's very helpful, right? Because when Andrew says to me, Fred, that's an ugly, the way I react to that reveals to me, whether I am really attached, whether I do have a strong opinion, right? And if I'm willing to listen to the feedback that reality is always giving me too. Reality means other people's situations. We also, right? Why do people keep doing the same thing and getting the same results and being surprised? Why? Because they obviously do not see the truth of what's happening. Why? Because they're blind. But you as an objective person may see what this person's doing and saying, what? I mean, can't they see it? It's right in front of their eyes. They keep doing the same thing. It keeps not working, keeps causing him misery, and yet, we say, I can't believe she went back to him again. Right? Blind. Blind to what? Blind to the truth of the suffering of that. Right? And all you gotta do is open your eyes and you see the truth. But who's willing to open their eyes? And what is it that keeps bringing us back? what is it? Fear, craving, you know, all that stuff. Right? That's what's functioning. Loneliness, seeking happiness outside ourselves, thinking we can find it in an object, in a relationship, in a thing, right? And all that. But it's all, again, we start blind. We are through the teaching and through the practices, we are given tools that we can begin to see. We're given glasses. We still may be blind, but we're given glasses. And over time, we'll have a radical surgery and we'll see again. Somebody?
So, all thought, perception, ideas of knowing that are generated by the mind.
The only hope we have is to be in practice, to not be attached to those. That's what generates the insanity, is that it? The attachment to those perceptions or ideas or mental formations?
Well, it's not that simple, but that's a good working hypothesis. It's good to at least know that thoughts about things are not the same as things. Okay? That my thoughts about Andrew are just my thoughts. They're not Andrew, right? That's Andrew. And if I want to know Andrew, I have to be present to him as he is and not how I think about him, whether it's flowers or tea or sounds or nature or people. So, okay, thoughts and perceptions are not the same as reality. That's a given. Now, we do, as human beings, have this incredible capacity for generating thoughts, right? As some of you might have noticed, right? Now, what we want to do is correctly attribute labeling and stop mislabeling. Right? So we want our thinking, you know, to be correct. What does that mean? That means that when we see these flowers, we see them as they are. But we also know that they are impermanent. Right. That they do not have any self-nature. That is only because of causes and conditions that they've come together in this form, and as causes and conditions change, they will change too. So we see things clearly even when we think about things. Right? The Buddha sees clearly that everything is impermanent, non-self, you know, and has the basis for unsatisfactoriness if it is grasped. So we want to practice what's called right thinking, if we are going to have thoughts. Right? We all have thoughts. We might as well have thoughts, right? Like we might as well have open thoughts rather than closed thoughts. We might as well have compassionate thoughts if we're going to have thoughts. They say the Buddha has no thoughts. Just totally, total uncontaminated, pristine awareness, just responding to situations as they arise, coming from a place of wisdom without a thought. Now, most of us are not there. So the question is, you know, Jill, the question is too, how can I begin to see more clearly that these are just thoughts and not let them run my life? And two, how can I learn to think in a way that my thought processes are in touch with They're kind of wise. They're intelligent. You know, they don't confuse things. They clarify things. Is that clear? So to have a thought, to hold no opinion for and against, that's a good thought. I want to be free of suffering. That's a good thought. Right? So when we enter Dharma, our thoughts are running us all over the place. Right? They are the source of suffering and confusion and delusion. And we want to learn to no longer give heed to that types of thinking. And have the capacity of generating thoughts that move us in the direction of where we want to go. So again, you know, if you say to me, Fred, would you rather have coffee or tea? I can say what? Tea. Why do you want tea? I like tea. It's okay. But if there's no tea, I can either do without or I can have coffee. It's no big deal. To set up what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind. Why don't we'll just spend a few minutes on this one and then we'll call it a day. I like this one. I like this concept, disease of the mind. To set up what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind. And we're talking about all oppositional thoughts. I like the concept, disease of mind. See, it's a concept. But it's a concept that we are using to help bring clarity, hopefully, not confusion. So it's good thoughts. You know, that's why you see many monastics, they spend lots of time memorizing teachings and practices. And then they're always doing recitations and ceremony, you know what I mean? Because they're wanting to make sure that if their mind is generating thoughts, at least they're generating thoughts that are in accord with Dharma, accord with truth. Right? Truth now in a conceptual way. Right? If you can have thoughts, why not have good thoughts? If you can have thoughts, why don't you have kind thoughts? If you can have thoughts, why don't you have intelligent thoughts? Rather than, you know, if you're going to have thoughts, why don't you have selfless thoughts? Thoughts not tinged with self. It's a good start for transformation, transforming the mind. So, to set up what you like against what you dislike is a disease of the mind. The concept of disease of the mind. Oh, let me just say something. Did you say anything about the missing person?
No, I
did not. Oh. The young woman, Kat, I'm pointing to her. It turns out Kat just very recently had surgery on her heart and had really been told by her physicians to take it easy and not to drive and not to do anything. And somehow she came here because she didn't really listen to her physicians. So anyhow, she began to have a few little kind of mild arrhythmia, of nothing of seriousness. But I think all of a sudden it dawned on her that she was an hour or two away from a hospital, that if anything happened, and you know, and that kind of just raised her level of uncomfort being here. I mean, she realized that this was probably not a good choice. And she was getting concerned about being so far away from a hospital and her doctor and all that. So we all agreed that'd probably be good to leave for her. So anyhow. Speaking of disease, So, the concept of disease of the mind needs to be understood in relationship to what it means to have a healthy mind. Okay. And this is very important. And actually, I've been talking about this somewhat in the sanghas recently. And the analogy is, we know we're sick because we know what we are like when we are healthy. Right? When we have a baseline of what it feels like to be in our body when it is healthy, when it begins to deviate from that baseline, we say what? I'm getting sick. And we, continue on from getting sick to being sick, to being very sick, right? To really being ridden with disease, right? There's a whole, and I guess, terminal is probably the end of that one. So a diseased body, an unhealthy body, ill health, can only be understood in relationship to health. Is that clear? I mean, if you had grown up in a state of significant physical disorder, but that's all you had ever known, you might consider that your baseline. And it only may be when that changes that you think you're getting sick. Is that clear? Health is a relative experience, but it is... Disease is based on an awareness of a healthy body, a well-functioning body, free of disease. Is that clear? So, the problem is when we come to the mind, I've realized, in our culture, we have no real common sense of what it means to have a healthy mind, and that is the baseline. So when we leave that healthy mind, we know we're getting sick. And when we get very sick, we probably have a disease. So it is interesting that the third patriarch says that whole thing of opinions for and against and likes and dislikes and the whole way we discriminate, and he calls that what? The activities of a diseased mind. So this is very profound, because it implies that each of us need to have at least a baseline, some felt awareness of what it is to have a healthy mind. So when we leave it, right, we can say, my mind is a little unhealthy today. Right? We don't talk this way, do we? We'll say, my body is getting a little sick today. My body is not very healthy today. But most people don't say, my mind is a little sick today. I better do something, right? Because, you know, when you go to the when you go to Walgreens or CVS or something, right? Even for all the minor aches and pains, right, of the body, right? I mean, every little part of your body. Here's the eye section. There's the ear section. There's the nose section. There's the throat section, right? There's the muscle section, right? I mean, it's just right. And this is just over a counter. You know, I mean, the real stuff is, you know, under lock and key, guarded by people in white coats. You know, but we're not allowed back there. But just wandering through the pharmacy, we can hit every part of our body that may be a little bit of suffering, right? And find something to help it. So people in our culture have a very acute sense of, right, when their body is not healthy. People are popping things all the time. because they are feeling unhealthy. But if we would say that a healthy mind is an open mind, is a spacious mind, is a content mind, is a mind at ease, is a friendly mind, is a compassionate mind, right? If those are the aspects of a healthy mind, naturally, then if that's our baseline, then when we leave it, when we all of a sudden begin to feel a little bit judgmental, a little bit unkind, a little bit opinionated, a little bit stressed, a little bit ill at ease, just a wee bit dissatisfied, we would say what? I'm getting sick. I'm getting sick. Right? But we don't do that. Right? We just let it unfold. Day after day, week after week, until it's just, as the third patriarch said, we just have this diseased mind that we think is normal. Right? You know, we think to have strong opinions for or against and to be endlessly wandering through anger and resentment and dissatisfaction and fear and anxiety and loneliness, you know, I mean, on and on and on, and alienation and anguish, and, you know, as normal. Right? Because people will very openly tell you, oh, I'm on, you know, I'm taking Xanax for my this, and I'm taking Ambien for this, and I'm taking Zoloft for that. You know what I mean? It's just, right? It's normal. Right, all right. You know, I need my drinks after work, right? To calm me down. And people, right? It's normal. The ways they have of dealing with their dis-ease of mind is pharmacological, or it's consuming, or watching, or, you know, it's like all this, rather than what Dharma says, which is, you know, it's the mind that is sick. You know, that's why we say Dharma. The teachings and the practice of Dharma are medicine for the mind, right? You know, they're antidotes and remedies for all the diseases of the mind. In this vast, it's not cornucopia. What's the whole range of medical knowledge and
it's a pharmacopoeia.
Yeah, pharmacopoeia, sort of. But anyhow, though, it's like this is the pharmacopoeia, we could say. Right? This is, for thousands of years, in all different kinds of cultures and countries, this has been the pharmacopoeia that people have gone to. And the teachers and the masters have been the doctors people go to cure their disease of mind. Is that clear?
No.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Thank you for standing up for medication. Yeah. Yeah, I am not saying, especially since we have a psychiatrist here, I don't want to put him out of business.
Thank you.
Got to earn a living, support a family, and all that. So, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's not to say. But I'm saying in general. Right, in general. Right? I mean, yeah, we're just staying with Angie's family, and her brother is a cardiologist. And when I said, in your practice, what percent of the people you see, are their heart problems caused by their diet, their lack of exercise. You know, I said half. He said half. I forget his numbers, like 80%. I mean, it was, you know, maybe it was 90%. I mean, it just, you know, I thought I was being, yeah, I mean, you know, 80% of his of the people he sees in his practice are there because of diet and exercise. You know, obviously they don't diet. They don't exercise. I mean, that's, right? So it doesn't mean that there aren't people who have, you know, like this young woman here had a hole in her heart, right? I would not say to her, you need to change your diet, right? And exercise and get Dean Ornish's book, right? On a healthy heart, and say, yeah, and please go see a cardiologist, right? But that's, you know, right? But you know that, you know, I mean, the vast number of medications for depression, anxiety, sleep disorders are given just across the board, right? I mean, most, yeah, I mean, most psychiatric medications are prescribed by who? Psychiatrists? What?
Family doctors.
Family doctors. I mean, so it's, that tells you that, you know, this stuff is considered normal. And, you know, it's not that I'm faulting medicine for treating when people come to them and complain about their suffering. But, you know, let's look deeply into the suffering and what's causing it. And are there very, you know, are there tried and true remedies available? To set up what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind. So next time you have strong likes and dislikes, see it as my mind is diseased. Now it's wonderful, as opposed to physical illnesses, right? Which maybe take some time to heal. This, that can be healed immediately. By what? Let go. Just let go. Immediately, you're healed. Could it be that simple? Just let go. You know, you're feeling tight and constricted? You're holding on to something. Let go. You're angry, resentful? You're holding on to something. Let go. You're worried about something? Let go. You're holding on. Holding on to a thought, holding on to a fantasy, holding on to a memory. Right? Let go. Immediately, health will be restored. Like magic. Doctors can't do that, can they? Mm-mm-mm. But in Dharma, we can do that.
Pharmacology.
But coming back to Beth's point, you know, we begin in blindness, right? But we're learning to see, and when we see, and when we can see that we, you know, that we are entering ill health. Stress, ill health. Anxiety, ill health. Worry, even, ill health. Tight, ill health. Judgment, ill health. Right. Just label correctly. And then see what it is you're holding on to and let it go. The great way is easy. For those who have no preferences. Why are you angry? Because you prefer somebody to be different than they are, right? Because you prefer what happened didn't happen. Right? Preferences. Let go of your preferences and what? Everything becomes clear and undisguised. Anyhow, yes. Yeah, those are all preferences. I mean, and again, we're using words, right?
Yeah, that would be a big... I notice that's how it presents itself to me a lot of times, right?
Yeah, which is means what? I prefer...
to me it's a little stronger. It's like society's behind me on a right and wrong.
Mm-hmm.
The preference, I kind of stand alone.
Nice. Right. But again, you know, from a societal sense, you know, the advancement of civilization, we have developed these standards of right and wrong, which again are changing and aren't enforced, right? I mean, what is it in the Ten Commandments? It's something about thou shalt not kill? What number was that? Well, I mean, that was up there, you know, and it's 5,000 years later, religious people are out there killing each other. So, right or wrong? Right. We need to look deeply. Good. So, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. Just let go of those fond opinions. You have enough work to do today. Right. Just watch them. Just watch them. And when you see them, hold them in your mindfulness. If there are deep ones, look deeply into them. Let them go. And see if you don't feel better. Right. When you're in that place of strong opinion, preference, disappointment, right now, how do you feel? Happy? Contented? At ease? You'd have to really be sick. I think that's called a sociopath or something. Most of us are not like that. When we enter the realm of diseased mind, we feel it. Right? So your body will tell. And then you have a choice. Dharma, again, is choice. Choice means I can't control what arises, but I can control how I respond to it. That's practice. Many people think practice is getting rid of all my thoughts. I mean, all the ones I don't want to have. But that's not what practice is about. Practice is when thoughts arise, how to hold them in mindfulness. Right? And then to do whatever needs to be done with them. Some thoughts just need to be let be and let them dissolve of their own. Self-liberation. Right? Some thoughts need to be changed, transformed. Some thoughts need to be looked into, depending on types. Depth. Right? But that's practice. It's a side of practice. Good. So it is 12:15. We have lunch in 15 minutes. So please take time to do a little walking meditation. And please enjoy your day with your opinions. You know, in behaviorism, you know, they give those little clickers. The count, those counters, you know, when they have people working in behavioral changes, maybe we should give that little clicker. We'll stop now.